Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen. It's up, it's up. And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Volume.
No! Oh my God! How could he do that?
Are you on
donate?
What?
Charles Darwin.
The Nerds is where it's at.
Welcome everybody back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Brever, and alongside me is Logan Camden, and we are back, baby. We're going to be breaking down all of today's action, starting with the finale tonight, which was the Minnesota Timberwolves yet again just handing the Suns their ass on a platter and asking how they like it, man. Just a convincing beatdown of a series, now up 3-0. This baby is obviously over. What do you take away from yet another easy win for Minnesota in this series, Logan?
It is convincing, and it's an easy win. I mean, if you weren't considering the Timberwolves to be a real contender, I think you're horribly mistaken. You know, I think the Timberwolves are for real. And the biggest thing that stuck out to me in this game and so far in this series, Phoenix just doesn't have anybody to match up with Minnesota defensively. Like, they don't have anybody where they're winning on the defensive side of the basketball court. Everything is a mismatch. If it's Rudy Gobert versus Nurkic, if it's Cat versus KD, if it's Ant versus anybody, the Suns can't hold anybody that Minnesota has. And it has just led to such easy, consistent offense for Minnesota, right? We questioned, Carson, whether that was going to be the Achilles heel of Minnesota coming into these playoffs. Are they going to be able to reliably generate enough offense to win a series or to get through and make a playoff run? When you don't have anybody that can hold Anthony Edwards at the point of attack, it's pretty easy. Like, yeah, all game long, either sending doubles, you cut your defense in rotation early, Ant's going to make that kick out pass, they're going to find the open guy, or Ant's going to blow right by you, get to the rack and create the advantage either way. Like, there have just been so many easy avenues for Minnesota offensively. The stark points in the paint advantage that Minnesota possesses. I think it was 56-36 in this game. They've had an advantage every single night in that category. And on the other side of the ball, Minnesota doesn't have to do that. They have defensive advantages everywhere. Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Rudy Gobert, Karl Anthony Towns, whatever roster construction, whatever lineup construction they're going with, for that moment, they match up well. Like, it is just a colossal, colossal mismatch, man, where Minnesota's just so much, the better team, man, on both sides of the ball. And Anthony Edwards put on a freaking show tonight, man. The pull-up jump shooting, the energy, man. Minnesota is just in a different league, in a different class than Phoenix, man.
Totally in a different class. And I picked Minnesota to win this series. We both did, but T-Wolves fans, I apologize for thinking this would be a close series. I apologize for thinking this would be even a competitive series. This is an ass-kicking of epic proportions. Logan, you mentioned the point in the paint differential. Minnesota in this series is plus 46 in terms of points in the paint versus Phoenix. They are plus 43 on the glass. This is as dramatic an example of bully ball winning out convincingly as you could possibly imagine seeing in a playoff series. They are way bigger. They are way more physical. They are way better defensively. They have way better depth. They have much clearer direction. They have more guys you trust to make decisions and to handle and to knock down open looks. Like, just everything that was true in game one has remained true through game three. And that's why, even when you didn't have good Ant and Cat in game two, the supporting cast was so much better. The defensive foundation was so elite that they still blew these guys off the court. It's incredible what we are seeing from Minnesota right now. This team is playing at such a high level. And I had them going into the playoffs, or a couple weeks before when we did our contender rankings, as my number four contender overall, my number three contender in the West. Right now, they are playing a level above everybody out West not named Denver. I mean, in this series, they've been more impressive. Obviously, we just have the utmost faith in Denver. But I'm not saying the Mavs can't reach that level. They just haven't. Like, this is such impressive consistency. And on the flip side, the Suns are out here embarrassing themselves. And the roster construction here is the first glaring problem. This is what we've discussed. Even when you have all this shot making on the floor, if you don't consistently pressure the rim and you don't make a high volume of threes, what is the result of that going to be? It can be good offense. It's not going to be great offense. Coming into this game, they had made the fewest threes per game in the playoff field, this incredibly jump shooting heavy team. And in this game, they had four made threes going into the fourth quarter. Yippee. Bradley Beal with a great stat pad. Who cares? Like, this game was over. And of course, they're completely failing to score in and around the rim because of Rudy Gobert as a deterrent, because of the collective length of this Minnesota defense. And those guys are doing such an unbelievable job up at the point of attack of applying ball pressure, of frequently picking these dudes up full court, and they just aren't quick enough to beat them off the bounce and to punish them for it and to put the defense in rotation so Minnesota can stay home and just force these guys into tough shot after tough shot. Minnesota is great, but this is also just unserious stuff that we're seeing from the Suns, and this team told us exactly who they were in the regular season, Logan. Like I mentioned, they may have a lot of star names offensively. They were still just the number 11 offense in basketball. They were a disaster in the fourth quarter. That hasn't even mattered in this series. But crucially, they were not built for the physicality of this moment. This was a team that was going to play small, that was very slight, that ultimately didn't have any defensive-minded players in that core starting five. And they were going to need their stars to pick up some more responsibility on that side of the ball, and they just never did. And they faced, like, the most physical, the biggest team in basketball, and they just got embarrassed accordingly. This is a terrible look for Devin Booker. This is a terrible look for Kevin Durant. Like, over the course of this series, KD has been better. This game, Book's mid-range jumpers finally started falling. Yippee, he made some solid decisions as a facilitator. But it is the glaring limitations of both of them in their ability to pressure the rim and to ultimately just create opportunities for themselves that are high value and efficient, and also for their teammates. Like, these guys just were not up to the task. Neither of them played like an offensive number one in this series against a really great defense. And that was the vision. You had two offensive number ones. So they just got their ass kicked in every way, man. And it's been consistent across three games. And if you're Phoenix, you are just in a brutal, brutal spot organizationally because you have nothing to work with. You have these three guys who you're paying $160 million combined all the way through 2026, Logan. 2026, that is all your cap. They don't have a first-round pick of their own through 2030. Or actually, this year they do. But after that, they have three picks that they will lose outright in the first, and then they have three picks where they will get the worst out of a swap. They have one second-round pick through 2030. That will also be the worst out of a swap. They are in as bad a position as any team in the playoff field, because they are not close. They have all their chips in, and they are not close. This is the most dominant, convincing, yeah, wrap this thing up, this series is over, that has gone down right now, and it's against a team that people viewed as a contender coming into this year, and that's just a very, very brutal reality for them to have to deal with as an organization right now.
It's a super brutal reality, and I mean, there's just a lot of questions that are going to come up in this offseason about what you do with these guys. Do you shop Beal? Do you shop KD? I mean, I don't really see like a silver lining.
Nobody is taking on Bradley Beal. Nobody is taking on that contract.
I just fail to find any positives for the Phoenix Suns to take away from this season or this amalgamation of players. Like, are Beal and KD going to get better? No. I mean, the only hope is that them playing, again, like I've stressed on so many times we've talked about the Suns, is that somehow they'll figure out how to play together. There's always going to be at a role player disadvantage when these three guys are on the roster. They're always going to be at a that's it. Like you're just going to struggle to find quality guys to fill out your rotation because you're trying to do it on bargain bin minimum contracts. You have no money to allocate to the rest of your roster. Pretty important. You know, I mean, we got caught up in the big three thing for a while. And when the league's not really talented, you can get away with playing Joel Anthony playoff minutes, man. Can't do that in 2024, man. You need dogs up and down the lineup, and the Suns don't have them. I thought that you mentioned their jump shooting issues, you know, not really being able to kill teams from behind the arc. I thought the absence of Grayson Allen was huge in this game. Just not having him out there to space the floor. And I don't know, man. I think they need to pick a lead guy, Carson. I think they need to pick a dog that is going to run the offense. I think that's step number one. You need to pick one of these guys who's going to take all the possessions. If it's Book, if it's a Beal, we are deferring to this guy. We are running the offense through him. He's going to be our lead guy, and he's going to set this thing up and go. We have to get something established, man. The only offense I did like from the Suns was when KD would take a post touch and like back a guy down. And sometimes
early in this game, they had an actual good approach. KD was cutting actively. They were pressuring the rim some, which they haven't done all series. And then that stopped pretty quickly.
Yeah. And there's a lack of a game plan along with the roster construction issues. And honestly, Carson, the one thing that I really will put on these stars, because they all pull their weight statistically, is the lack of fight. This is a 2-0 series. I mean, this is back against the wall. You have nothing else to fight for. This is it. These two quarters, you know, that you have remaining coming out of the first half. And there was just a lack of effort, man. I think the Suns are done. Much like the Lakers, like, I really would be surprised if either of these teams pull off even one win against these teams. They're just superior, but also, like, I just don't know how you can get these guys up to get ready and to go to play. And there is nothing to look forward to. I mean, the Suns might have set themselves back a decade, man. This feels like Brooklyn Nets levels of destruction. You know, I would just hate to be a Suns fan right now. There's nothing to look forward to.
Well, you just look at the result. I think of the biggest actual big three failure as being, well, actually, it was even a big four. But what the 2013 Lakers did, bringing in very old Steve Nash, who was hurt, bringing in Dwight Howard to join that tandem of Kobe and Powell, and that team got bounced easily in the first round. Like, that is just the ultimate, oh, wow, look at this Sports Illustrated cover, and then we all laugh at how mediocre they ultimately were. That was going all in on a core that was aging and trying to do it with these flashy stars from different situations who ultimately didn't fit right. At least that team had the excuse of being hurt in the playoffs. Like, this team was healthy. That was one of the big red flags. It was, oh, are we going to get Beal and KD and Book all out there at the same time? You did. Grayson Allen goes down in game two. But come on, man. Like, everybody deals with something in the playoffs. You have to have enough capable players on your roster to survive Grayson Allen's absence. And even then, they were getting their ass kicked with him out there. So you don't get that excuse. It's a poorly composed roster. And absolutely, this has set them back. And when you have the opportunity to get a Kevin Durant, I certainly understand the temptation. But as we've said before, that roster was far away last year, pre-KD, because of CP3's regression. And then you had to give up basically all your best assets to get KD. And so you weren't in a position to just spring into contention. And you especially weren't if your superstars aren't going to play up to that level. And then the ultimate contrast to that is just like this beautifully composed team that you have in Minnesota, where there are so many dudes who you trust to step up, where you don't need Karl-Anthony Towns to close a game. I mean, there's been extended stretches of this series where foul trouble has been a factor, but sometimes, like, he's kind of clear on that front, and Chris Finch is just like, you know what? We have this super switchable unit. We have a bunch of dudes who are pests on the perimeter. We have a bunch of good decision makers and good shooters. We're just going to ride this lineup. We don't even need one of our three stars to play, and we are a dominant basketball team that is kicking your ass. The Suns couldn't conceive of a reality like that because their role players simply aren't close to good enough because they gave up everything to go all in on this big three. So there is a lot that's impressive about Minnesota. This is an exceptionally dominant defense, and the more I've thought about it, the more I've decided this isn't just the best defense in the league this year. This isn't even just the best defense of the last few years. I think this might be the best defense of the last decade, Logan. And there's a lot of good ones in there. You have the 2020 Lakers, the 2021 Bucks, the early Warriors in 15 and 16. You have the 2013 Pacers. That was a great team defense. I'm sure there's other iterations that I'm spacing out right now. The 2019 Raptors. But I think you have to go back to like the early 2010s Bulls, who were just dominant number one regular season defenses. And then translating that to the playoffs, they were absolutely huge. They had just multiple really high level versatile defenders. They grinded you down, super physical. This team has everything you want. They have multiple elite point of attack defenders who are all super long, who are all super athletic, who all have crazy motors, who navigate screens, who can take on a bunch of different matchups. They're huge on the interior, and they can play these two big looks where they just suffocate the glass, or they can play these lineups with an NAW alongside like the other starters. And then they're just crazy lethal on the perimeter, and they have one of the greatest rim protectors ever holding it down. And we've seen throughout this series, like, the Suns found a little bit of success in that fourth quarter. Bradley Beal hit a couple of threes off of Gobert switches where he just wasn't up close enough, but like they haven't been able to attack him. And by the way, that's another concerning thing, Logan. Kevin Durant is not getting a step on Karl-Anthony Towns and Naz Reid in this series. Like, those guys are able to guard him for significant stretches, and he doesn't get by them. He's taking tough mid-range looks no matter what. Book has been suffocated by the perimeter defense from Anthony Edwards and Jaden McDaniels and NAW, whoever they've thrown at him. It's just such a stark difference. But I really think this Timberwolves defense is special. And when we were evaluating this team, that was a reason that I did believe in them, even though they didn't fit the traditional mold of having like a tier 1A superstar right now, or having a consistently really good half court offense, boxes that normally you have to check. I felt this defense is so great that you should be able to get through a series, and maybe they could be the biggest threat to Denver. But it's been even more convincing in the playoffs. There's no holes. It's really, really exceptional. And they have just destroyed this Phoenix team. Like, Phoenix has a bunch of issues of their own that we've talked about, but their ability to lock these dudes up in single coverage, to not have to overhelp ever, to take away the rim, to take away these drive and kick threes, to force a bunch of turnovers, to apply that constant ball pressure, like, it's incredible.
It's the biggest thing in this series, man. It's the biggest advantage I think Minnesota has possessed. And, you know, apart with that, it's like, even if Gobert helps off too, even when the Suns create advantages, it's like they don't have enough guys around them to really make you, you know, punish you for poor defense. Like, they don't have a ton of, you know, great shooters when Allen's not out there. You're asking Eric Gordon and Royce O'Neal to start banging threes, and Gordon's a good shooter, but
I mean, those guys are both good shooters, but they're ultimately not even getting created good looks because Phoenix mm-hmm. isn't creating advantages.
And the one area I do want to give Minnesota in this game credit for where we expected them to lack is, you know, Carson, I think their depth has performed really well offensively. Shout out NAW, shout out Monte Morris, shout out Naz Reid for doing their thing. I think the big three has really done a good job offensively too, man. Gobert just staying aggressive and being ready around the rim for when guys mm-hmm. drive. Like, he has just been untouchable down there. The Suns haven't had an answer for him. Karl-Anthony Towns in this one. This is the game that Karstradamus prophesized, man. Big
well,
cat-
it was. Foul trouble kind of spoiled the party well, again.
Dude, he just – damn,
he
man.
He just needs to settle down. He literally just needs to calm down and just play more under control. He crashes hard for rebounds that he can't possibly get, picks up Dude. Just a couple dumb fouls in this game. Sometimes his drives are out of control, but that's just kind of the nature of his play style. When he has those guards, he can get a little uncomfortable and overly physical. But, like, Kat, just take a deep breath, man. You can't make every single play in the game.
That one offensive rebound in game two, did you see that one where he goes up and it looks like he thinks he's going to, like, I don't know, man. He thinks he's like Larry Nance or something coming in there, man. He's going to.
And he doesn't change his play style. He doesn't change if he has that second foul in the first quarter. If he has mm-hmm. that third foul, he's still making those plays. That's where he really frustrates me.
I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I didn't think the Suns did nearly a good enough job at attacking those guys when they were in foul trouble in the second
Everybody
quarter.
Everybody was in foul trouble.
Dude, Reed, Towns, and Gobert all had two fouls in the second quarter. Finch is playing Towns and Gobert. And the Suns stopped getting downhill. And I'm sitting there like, guys, get one of them off the court. Like, that is just an advantage that you can create. Like, Get Cat his third one. You're going to play 5 minutes without him on the floor. Get Gobert his third. You know, and I don't know. I thought the Suns should have attacked that more. But back to the main point, too, dude. Cat has a good game offensively. Gobert's had an awesome series. And the guy that's really changing my mind about him in these playoff contexts is Ant. For one reason, I've talked about his mentality before, man. Ant's a gamer. That guy just – there's certain guys that just when it is on a big stage, a big game, Ant cranks it up a notch, man. He is bred for the moment. He is bred to take over. I believe in him as the number one. And I will say this is probably not the series to be making this declaration. He's not going up against a single good point of attack or perimeter defender. So we will pause and we will wait to see when he actually gets a little bit of resistance. But bottom line, when his pull-up jump shot is hitting like this, Anthony Edwards is unguardable. And in 99% of defensive matchups against him, he will just have an athletic and physical pop advantage where nobody can stay in front of him. So, and I've been so, so impressed with Anthony Edwards in all three of these games with his decision-making as a lead guard, you know, where he doesn't really have to rely on Mike Conley as much. Mike Conley has done a phenomenal job of controlling the game for Minnesota, but Anthony Edwards has done a great job of making great decisions and playmaking for his teammates. And when the Suns send those doubles, he is not hesitating. It's, I'm going to get it to an open guy. And if I'm not finding the guy who's wide open, the guy who I just kicked it will find him. I have been so impressed with Anthony Edwards on the playoff stage. When I had major questions about him and how his game would translate, he's further along than I expected, man, in terms of mentality, in terms of shooting ability and decision-making. I've been really, really impressed with Ant in this series and all of Minnesota's big three on the offensive end.
Ant was phenomenal in this game. And his game one performance was the most electrifying with that 18-point third quarter. But this, to me, was the most impressive, especially because it didn't rely on just ridiculous pull-up shooting, which obviously is super impressive. But this was a game where it felt like he was consistently getting what he wanted on the floor. This was his most effective game as a driver. You mentioned they just could not stay in front of him. And if they weren't going to send that second defender, he was easily beating them off the bounce. I also thought that he just played with great pace on his drives, and his finishing was super impressive around the rim. And he was eating up free throws too, because they couldn't stay in front of him. They kept getting out of position and they kept fouling. But then also the mid-range was going. And at that point, it's like, all right, cool. He is unstoppable. And he did make some really nice passes out of doubles. There were a couple instances in which he got caught up and he got overly crowded and he didn't make a decision quickly enough. And that is something to monitor. Like, he's averaging 5 turnovers a game in this series and in spots has been affected by them consistently throwing a second defender his way, but also did a good job of creating advantages ever since the first quarter of game one, has gotten more comfortable seeing those looks and didn't force the issue with his pull-up jumpers in this game. I think that he was his best as a decision maker in this one. And it's also just good for him to continue to see these sort of looks at this volume, because that's going to be what he sees, right? Teams are going to force him to beat them with decision-making and try to bait him into those pull-up jumpers. And already within the series, I think that we've seen improvement there. And he's always played better in the playoffs than the regular season. It hasn't been a very large sample size, but part of that is he has gotten really hot as a pull-up shooter. But it's also just crazy strong athletes like him are built for the playoffs. Like, he just gets where he wants on the floor in a vast majority of matchups, and he was able to do that in this game. And also, dude, I got to give that dude so much props for what he's done defensively, because J-Dub is the star of the perimeter defense. He'll be all defense. Gobert is going to be defensive player of the year and has been phenomenal. He deserves it. But I didn't expect this level of consistency from Ant at this age. We saw a huge leap this year, but in college, he always had the tools. He obviously had the athleticism and the length, and he always showed flashes even in his earliest seasons in the league. But like, this dude is consistently playing at an all-defense, fringe all-defense level. He is applying just devastating ball pressure. He is using his length as a helper to really affect people with contests. He jumped a Bradley Beal backdoor cut, got a hand on it. He's just made some really high IQ plays, getting into passing lanes throughout this series, disrupting the offense. So, so impressive. Really important part of this phenomenal defense. And like you said, they can't guard Cat. Cat doesn't want to stay on the floor long enough for it to matter, because he wants to pick up his fouls. But he came out aggressive in this one. Bangs 2 threes early. couple really physical drives into good finishes and came out driving strong. His first couple possessions didn't get a whistle, but then he started finishing around the rim. I would have preferred to see more legit post-ups because I think that's where he's most effective, when he doesn't have to deal with the chaos of putting the ball on the floor, initiating from the three-point line, giving the defense time to help and disrupt him as a ball handler. Like, he was just bullying KD or whoever out of the post in game one, when he really had it going in that game too before he picked up the fouls. But still, like, they just didn't have an answer for him. And Gobert has been phenomenal, as you mentioned, really in every way, even like selective mismatch attacking, being consistently ready as a finisher around the rim, just being too overwhelmingly big. Conley's secondary creation has been so valuable. He's so composed. And they have two of the best bench players in the field, man. Naz Reid is sixth man of the year. We love Naz Reid. Everybody loves Naz Reid. Logan, for a playoff run, would you rather have him or NAW?
Naz Reid or NAW?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm taking Naz Reid.
I think I would take NAW.
Really?
What NAW does is so valuable, bro. He's one of like the 15 best perimeter defenders on the planet. He makes such good decisions with the ball, and he's knocking down 40% of his threes this year and has been particularly good in the playoffs and is just so confident stepping into those shots. I mean, you just have so much versatility with him on the floor. I think he does everything that you want from a guard wing role player at an extremely high level. Of course, Naz is flashier and he's more fun and he is a weapon, but Nikhil Alexander-Walker is like the ultimate 3-and-D player right now, just an absolute stud, and he is having such a positive impact every time he's on the floor.
I mean, he's having a great series, and he's a great player, no doubt. I think that's kind of a wild take, man.
I don't, dude. I think they're going to continue to lean on him in a big way. I mean, there's a reason that he's getting all these big minutes, Logan. I think oftentimes their best lineup configurations – feature him, and at times that's excluding Cat from it just because they're so quick and they're so good defensively on the perimeter. I do want to give Cat props though, because I thought he had a lot more trouble guarding in space in their regular season matchups than he has in the playoffs. He really hasn't had that much trouble. He's pretty much held his own, and that just makes this series all the more impossible for Phoenix to win.
The only thing I want to add is, I mean, I agree with you on the NAW point, man. It does give them a ton of versatility. In game two, I mean, for most of the fourth quarter at the start, they were closing with NAW instead of Ant. You know, it was Conley, NAW, Cat, Gobert, and then McDaniels. Like, Ant wasn't having a good shooting game, and they just rode the hot hand, and they didn't lose a whole lot. Like, defensively, he was clamped. He was knocking down shots. I can't go against a boy Naz Reid, though, man.
Nothing wrong with it.
I think I like the fact that at the five spot, Naz is such a weapon. He's not a complete liability defensively. You know what I mean? He can make plays there. He's athletic, but I just like the floor spacing capabilities from my bench five, man. I think that's really valuable to have off the bench.
The good news is the Timberwolves don't have to choose. My point was more, I think they are at the very least playing at a comparable level, and that's crazy to have off the bench.
It is. I mean, they legitimately have like a, I think you'll understand what I mean by this, but like, they have a bad starting five off the bench. Like, you know, but it's a starting five. Like, dude, Monte Morris, Kyle Anderson, NAW, Naz Reid.
Those
like,
dudes have started in the league. Kyle Anderson and Monte Morris have started in the league a lot. Yeah.
It's like,
and I like both those guys. They're a level below, but very solid and dependable in their own ways.
100%. Like, would that team go out and beat the Wizards? Maybe. Maybe. I might trust them to knock off the Wizards, man, or the Pistons, or one of these other teams. Like, it is – the Timberwolves have insane depth, have so many good role players that just do their job, man. They're loaded. I'm really high on Minnesota, man, and I think I agree with you. I had Dallas above them heading into these playoffs, and like you said earlier too, I think Dallas can get to this level. Minnesota's showing it right now, night in, night out.
Dallas can't get to this level. It's going to depend on Luka. We'll talk about it. But boy, this is a great collective group. I am so excited to see them play Denver, because I would quite confidently pick Denver. I just think it's a bit much to ask Minnesota to produce offensively at the level that they need in that series against a team that is much bigger than Phoenix and defends much better, where they don't have this sort of just obvious physical advantages. But nobody gives that Denver offense more trouble. Really, nobody gives that Denver offense any trouble but Minnesota. And so that is a very fun dynamic to throw at them. Any last words on Phoenix, dude?
No, it's Reed.
All right. I guess that's just going to be how you conclude
everything.
We can do the real funeral when
that's
lose.
What I'm wondering. I don't.
All right. We'll see.
It definitely feels like we're going to get the bouquets. We're going to get the flowers and the headstone, and we'll get the coffin ready for Phoenix. We'll bury him next game because I do think it's over. And
it's over.
Yeah. We can go in depth. And it's not just over for like, man, it might be over for the next decade for the Suns, man.
They're broken, dude. They are broken. And there's a valuable lesson. Legitimately for everybody, especially for one Kevin Durant, but in, I'm going to call it the fetishization of just super tough shot makers. Yeah, because you know what? There's something a little bit weird about it. I think people get their rocks off to the idea of just, ooh, look at all these buckets coming together. Ooh, what if we put Caris LeVert and Cam Thomas on the same team? Like, that's kind of what the Suns have done on a much higher level, obviously. And I've talked before about how they didn't have good options when they traded for Beal, and I still think that was a good value proposition, and they were kind of already screwed. But just in terms of like still holding out hope that, oh, maybe this team will get red hot and they'll beat Minnesota. No, they are lacking in a bunch of ways, and Minnesota has exposed that and just kicked their ass.
In the other take from the offseason thing, I agree with you on the Beal part. But back to the KD one, it's like when you go in, and when I can't fault the Suns for it. You had a chance to get Kevin Durant on the table. The way Kevin Durant was playing, he's a top 10 player on the planet. You could argue that he still is. When you go in on the wrong superstar, you give up too many assets that kill your depth, kill your rotation. It can set your franchise back years, and I think that's what the Suns have fundamentally done, man. I can't really fault them for making the moves like it is. It's shiny. It's, hey, it's KD. It's Beal, but it just didn't work, man. I would take notes if I'm a GM, man. The Suns are in a very, very, very dark place, man.
They'll get to appear in the playoffs for the next few years. That'll be their reward. Like, they are so far away, and they don't have the resources to change that. So, sorry, Suns fans. We're going to take a quick break, and then, of course, we're going to talk about the other two games of the night. We're going to start with Mavs Clippers, but first some quick words from DraftKings.
The 82 game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more.
Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code NERDS. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code NERDS only on DraftKings. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
So Mavs Clippers, Logan, this was a very highly anticipated series. They split games one and two. Of course, LA takes game one quite easily without Kawhi on the floor. He has returned for games two and three, although has pretty clearly been off. Dallas holds their home court down here. They take a 2-1 lead in this series. What did you take away from this game?
This was an awesome Mavericks defensive game, man. This is the lowest amount of points that Dallas has allowed in a single game all season long. They hold the LA Clippers to 90 points, man. I mean, it was a really impressive game from them on that side of the ball. I think it starts with Lively and Gafford just dominating the paint. There were so many massive blocks in this game. You know, I believe Lively totals two. Gafford comes away with three and two steals. PJ Washington has been awesome in this series, man, and just in a different role where they're asking him to clamp up and shoot shots, and PJ can do that, and he has played an awesome role on this team. Josh Green, when he gets plugged in, has given the Mavericks really great minutes, and Luka Doncic played a really great defensive game, man. I'm not ready to call Luka a really good defender, but when he wants to, man, Luka gives you those glimpses. I thought he did a really good job tonight, man, on the glass, on defense, active hands in passing lanes. like the Mavs really disrupted the Clippers in a way I didn't expect. And offensively too, man, everything came easy for Dallas in this game. Gafford and Lively getting downhill, dude. They dominated the paint. They had 28 points on 14 of 19 shooting in the first half. They end this game with 52 points in the paint to the Clippers, just 38. Dude, that high pick and roll was unstoppable. I was saying it from game one. I was like, Dallas, like, it's an unstoppable action. When you can pull Zoo up out of the paint when they're running that drop or just get him to hedge a little bit, that backside is going to be open, and it was all game long. Luka was spamming alley-oops to Gafford and Lively. So much easy offense. And this is not a good Luka game. I was honestly a little disappointed with him offensively. Like, you know, he gets his counting numbers like he always does. 22 points, 10 boards, and 9 assists, but 7 of 25 from the field, 3 of 13 from behind the arc. Like, I think if you just look at the counting numbers, you may go, oh, man, you know, Luka dominated this one, found his teammates.
That's a bad Luka game in the counting stats. If Luka Doncic did that, his averages would go way down.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Kyrie may get a little overshadowed. Kyrie carried them through in the second half, man, was just crazy. Like, it was a really slow start, but in non-Luka minutes, he scores 8 straight in the third. He hits a pull-up three, has some nice cuts to the bucket. He hits 2 big clutch fourth quarter pull-up threes, just daggers. Like, so they needed Kyrie. They needed Kyrie, and he pulled his weight in the third and fourth quarter, man. Like, the energy, the effort we got all game long from Dallas was super impressive. Kyrie's secondary shot creation. And the Clippers lay a dud, man. The Clippers are not going to go anywhere with this version of Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. I don't know. Do you want to get into that now, or do you want to start with Dallas, man? Because that's a pretty big key in this game, too.
We'll start with Dallas, but this was definitely a healthy mix of Dallas defending well and the Clippers offense just being porous. This was just a really ugly basketball game. I would say that this was one of the worst games of the playoffs so far, just in terms of the quality, like just a bit of a rough watch. But the story is the level that Dallas has defended at over these last couple games after a really bad start in game one that was mostly on the offense, but they were defending poorly as well. And they have responded since then. And this was the huge difference in this team down the stretch. Yeah, they were turning out really good offense, but they were doing that all year because they have Luka and Kyrie. It was being able to consistently play as like a top 8 defense, to be able to compete on the glass, to be so much bigger and longer and more athletic in the front court. And you see that in this game, man. Tim Hardaway Jr. out with that injury, so you don't have him on the floor in this one. Every guy who they played outside of Luka and Kyrie is a plus defender. And that is just such a dramatic difference from where they were at last year. And I just continue to be so impressed with how they have overhauled this team, because when they made the Kyrie trade, my feeling was they're too far away. They're too far away and they're giving up like some of their last remaining good assets. And what is this team going to do without like a DFS? And in one offseason, they have dramatically changed those dynamics. I thought that they overdrafted Lively. They did not. Well, one offseason and a trade deadline, because the PJ and Gafford trades are both huge. And so, yes, you need your two stars to carry a massive load as creators every single night. And you need these role players who are sometimes spotty offensively to knock down the open shots that are created for them. But defensively, man, the collection of quality players that you're getting is so impressive. And that's been the backbone. They're the number 5 defense in the playoffs so far. They're just the number 11 offense. They have been winning on the back of limiting this Clippers offense. Josh Green, just a ball of energy, man. So many high-effort plays in this game. Multiple offensive boards, but also drew multiple offensive fouls, had a big steal, got in those passing lanes, just got involved. And you mentioned the rim protection, Logan. Such a massive factor. They have the length of Derrick Jones Jr. and PJ Washington when those guys are involved as helpers to bother you. But Lively and Gafford both, they're just massive in there. And they're both so good. The Clippers are only making 11 shots per game in the restricted area in this series. That is 15th out of 16 playoff teams. And they are shooting under 52% in the restricted area. Not only is that dead last, to put that in perspective, league average, like during the regular season, is about 67%. So when you are holding teams at the rim to shooting 52%, like, that is an unbelievable testament to what Dallas has been doing on the interior. Also, though, does speak to the limitations of this Clippers team
and their athletes. And this was just a really, really disappointing game from them. I don't know what was wrong with Paul George in this one. Kawhi has the excuse of very obviously being hurt. And we talked about that in game two, how he just clearly wasn't able to assert himself to the normal level. And he wasn't hitting his jumpers. He was leaving a lot of them short. So you wonder if he's getting enough lift. But he only plays 25 minutes in this game. He has 9 points. He misses an extended stretch of the first half. And you could just see, like, there is no explosion there. Kawhi isn't exactly toasting people with quickness regularly, but I think his quickness can get a little bit underrated. There's multiple turnovers in this game where he just, like, loses the ball outright. And there's that one sequence where he catches the lob, and then he hangs on the rim for, like, 6 seconds. And he looks like a kid that climbed up on the monkey bars and got scared and didn't realize how high up they were. And they were like, oh, wow, I really don't want to fall. Like, that's not good, man. I thought that that was telling just about his confidence in his knee right now. So without him close to his normal level, they're not winning the series. But then PG, he's in foul trouble early, so he doesn't play a ton in this first half. He made some nice interior passes to Zoo, who, by the way, had a really nice game. But he took a bunch of tough jumpers, and that's always the thing with PG is he's an incredible jump shooter, but there are stretches where he is giving you nothing but tough jumpers. And when he's shooting over these really long, rangy Dallas defenders, it's not a great offensive diet. And then the two times that he got to the rim in this game, he was immediately met by a whole lot of length from that Dallas interior defense. They have three incredible blocks on him going up for, like, these monster vintage PG dunk attempts. Two of them have been Daniel Gafford, who is just doing an awesome job of protecting the rim. So props to the Mavs perimeter defense. Josh Green hounded him. I mean, that one possession where PG hit that off-balance circus shot, like, Josh Green damn near caused him to pick up his dribble like twice on that play alone. And then obviously he lost his balance. Like, he was giving him fits, just happened to somehow make that shot. And Derrick Jones Jr. did a really good job. And if those two play like that, you're not winning. It doesn't matter what you get from Harden. It doesn't matter what you get from Norman Powell and Zoo. When PG and Kawhi combine for 16 points, like, you can just kiss that game goodbye. And I'm worried really about what version of Kawhi you're getting at all in this series, because he's not going to make some miraculous recovery. Like, the guy's just not right.
I'm petrified, man. We had Kawhi as our, damn, man, what, number four scorer in the league? We had him up there.
Yeah, you know, and like number seven playoff performer, whatever, because he has consistently been ridiculous. And 30 points per game on 63% true shooting in the playoffs since 2019. He always delivers, but he's not healthy right now.
And healthy Kawhi would be even higher on the list. I mean, it's not even a question. Like, It's just got to be demoralizing for Clippers fans, man. Are we ever going to be able to see this trio remotely healthy when they're in their prime? It's closing fast, man. It's getting scary, dude. Kawhi, 25 minutes in this game, 9-9-2, 4-7 from the field, 4 turnovers. You talk about those 2 turnovers. I've never seen that from Kawhi, man. Kawhi is a guy who is perpetually locked in. Not only did he not look like, you know, game ready or up to game speed, he dribbles one off his foot in this game where I'm like, what? You know, I've never seen that. There was another bad decision in the fourth quarter where he just rushed a pass. Like, normally Kawhi is just so under control, so methodical, just ready. Like, and he has not looked like that at all in this series. 2 games played. 12-8-2 on 46% from the field and 0-5 from behind the arc. You mentioned Paul George. Gives you 7-5-5 on 3-11 from the field and 1-6 from deep on the series. 17 points, 4 boards, 4 assists on 40% shooting and 30% from behind the arc. Ironically, Carson, my best friend, James Harden, has been the best player in this series. Like, what? And not only that, like, Harden has legitimately floated this offense and kept in some of these games where if Harden is not doing this, is not turning back the clock and knocking down these step back threes, the Clippers aren't even in these games. These are drubbings from Dallas. In this one, he gives you 21-2-5 and bangs 5 threes. On the series, Harden has given us 24 points, 3 boards, 7 assists on 48% from the field and 45% from deep. Harden has been legitimately great, but like you said, man, when you get Kawhi at this level, when you get Paul George at this level, everything else has to go right. And despite those guys having abysmal games, the Clippers would have had a chance to win this if they didn't shoot themselves in the foot. Zoo 8, Norman Powell 8. But they lose the turnover battle 19-8. You got Norman Powell's dumb fouls veering into Josh Green intentionally. You got a moving screen. You got the uncharacteristic Kawhi turnovers that I mentioned. And then you get James Harden on that backdoor kick to PG where PG's just not ready for it. The Clippers kill themselves in this game. And Russ has his stinker. We know how volatile he can be. 0-7 from the field, scoreless from the field, 0-4 from deep as 1 point comes from that free throw line. I will ask, like, I mean, I don't think P.J. Washington should have been ejected, man. Are you with me?
No, I am with you. That was on Russ, dude. And Russ came with that energy that was walking the line from the jump. Like, first quarter, he made some great defensive plays. He stripped Luka twice. He had an awesome help side block. But then there's, like, the closeout where he hits Luka long after the whistle is blown, and he's just doing one of those shots where – obviously, it's a dead play. A guy just wants to get a shot up. There was another chippy play in there somewhere, and then that was way over the line. And he, like, threw a punch. He threw a punch at PJ pretty much. Like, you had to get him out of the game. And refs, generally, I feel like at that point, they're just like, let's get all this energy off the floor, especially when it's not that competitive of a game at that point. But I didn't think PJ did anything ejection-worthy.
Well, that's what I hate. Dude, that's what I hate about the NBA nowadays, or just sports in general, it's like we lose all social norms and it's just like common sense. It's like we can glean exactly what happened from this social interaction because we are also humans. Russell Westbrook is frustrated because he hasn't hit a shot from the field. And so he fouled Luka Doncic really hard. And when Luka was coming up to him, Westbrook was still a little pissed, so he pushed him. PJ Washington is telling you, hey, man, that's our leader. You're not going to touch him. If you touch my guy, I'm going to touch you. And all PJ did, all PJ did was give him a little love tap. It was, hey, man, don't touch my boy. And it's like,
friendly, good natured.
Like, he's just telling him, don't do that again or I'm going to mess you up. It's going to be your head. And I don't get why the refs can't go. PJ sticking up for his boy. Like Russell Westbrook.
I wonder if he said something vile, though, because Russ reacted strongly.
I don't know. I think Russ was a little heated. And if that was the case, because that's what Reddick said on the broadcast, too, was maybe PJ said something that, you know, got him a little riled up. I didn't think PJ should have been ejected, and I wondered if it was going to come back to bite him because PJ is vital to the Dallas's recipe for winning, but I just thought that was a bad call, man. I thought Russ should have been chucked, but I didn't think PJ deserved to get bounced in that game.
I agree. Russ, you mentioned 2-for-16 over his last two. He's made some really nice defensive plays. He's brought effort and energy and pace, but when he just can't make a shot, that's rough. And it was awful shooting from the Clippers outside of Harden. They were 5-of-21 from deep. Props to Harden for, again, just nailing his pull-up threes. I mean, he has been dialed in there in this series, but as you mentioned, they didn't take good care of the ball, so just a really bad performance from them offensively. Props to Zoo, though, because he was finishing beautifully in the dunker spot and as a cutter, and Norman Powell, you mentioned, had a couple dumb plays in there, but also just brought an infusion of offense that this team desperately needed. But it was also not a good game for the Mavs offense, and particularly not a good game for Luka Doncic, Logan, and I think that you even undersold how bad of a game it was by Luka's standards, because this is Luka Doncic. He's one of the greatest offensive players ever. He's a top two offensive player in the game today. And he still mostly picked LA apart with his passing. You mentioned, hit a beautiful lob to Lively, over drop, hit him very nicely off a blitz to create just a wide open layup, through three different lobs in transition throughout this game. But 7-of-25 with 5 turnovers is bad. And by the way, Kyrie got hot, but he had 2 points at the half. He's had a weird series, too, where he's quiet, and then he explodes. I expect him to be more consistent going forward, too. Like, he hasn't been at his best in this matchup either, and they still won comfortably. So that's a good sign for the Mavs. But in the first quarter, he gets stripped by Russ a couple times, as I mentioned. But really, my problem with Luka throughout this series has been his shot selection, and it has been his overwhelming reliance on his jump shot and tough jumpers. Like, he takes several deep threes in this game that are just not good looks. And Luka is improved as a jump shooter. He was the best he's ever been from deep by a good bit this season. He is
one of the top two step back shooters that we've ever seen. And the other one was on the floor just in terms of insane volume while maintaining good efficiency. But he's got to hit that paint more. He has to drive more because he is such a great decision maker in the paint at 6'8", being able to see everything. Like, you see the skip passes that he can make. You see a phenomenal mid-air adjustment to kick out to, I believe it was Maxi Kleba in the corner. Like, that's what he does. He dissects you out of drop. He'll throw those lobs over the top, but he has to get into that painted area. He shoots 55% on floaters. Like, everything in there is a huge positive. And Logan, it is ridiculous how little he is getting in there. He drove on one Zoo switch in this game, and he scored easily. Every other time, there were four other Zoo switches. He stepped back. He had one of those blocked. I often think that all Luka needs to guarantee he's going to make a step back is to see Ivica Zubac in front of him, because he always shoots the step back against him. Usually he makes a lot of them, but they just weren't falling in this one, and they were so predictable. There's another time where he tries to get Zoo with a pump fake and just doesn't bite, and then he just throws the ball away. Like, bring him out, man. Bring him out high, 28 feet away, and then you can get a step on that dude. 40 of his 77 shots in this series have been threes, and he's only making 30% of them. He has attempted five shots in the restricted area this series, Logan. And to put that into perspective, Luka's rim attempt rate has gone down, and it's been at a career low this season. But when you compare that to 2020 and 2021, when he played the Clippers, he was taking over five restricted area shots per game, 5.2 per game across those two series. That just gives him such a high floor as an offensive player. It's better for his scoring efficiency and volume. It's better for his playmaking to be consistently hitting that paint. And he's just been concerningly underwhelming through three games. Because, yeah, of course the counting stats are going to look good. It's Luka. He was not good in game one on either side of the ball. He was better in game two. But in this one, the shot making was just really, really rough. And the shot selection was really rough. And I'm a little concerned about that knee now, because he has been playing like this. Like, we had the same complaint through the first two games, but he tweaked that knee on the rust strip in the first quarter. And I don't know, it felt maybe even a little bit more dramatic to me in this game, but also he just wasn't making those shots. Regardless, they need way better Luka. If you don't have way better Luka, you're not going to make the deep run that we're optimistic this Dallas team can, because that defensive foundation is awesome and Kyrie can be really good, but you don't have enough offensive skill around those guys to have anything other than great Luka. And great Luka has been considered automatic, inevitable, because that's what he's done this year. That's what he's done in the playoffs previously, but they haven't gotten that guy yet. And that's a little concerning.
Well, and it's frustrating too, because you see glimpses of Luka do it during the game. There's one time where he drives the lane, gets two defenders. Zoo comes with him, dumps it off to Derek Lively for an easy dunk. There's another possession in this game where he gets Norman Powell on him out of a pick and roll and just takes him to the left elbow. The left low block. They're at the right elbow when he gets the screen. And Luka's so strong, he pushes him with his left forearm to the left elbow, easy floater. It's like, Luka has a competitive advantage against most of the guys that are going to be on the floor for the Clippers. If it's Zoo, he's got a speed advantage. If it's Norman Powell, he's got a strength advantage. Like, I don't think he's exploited the Clippers enough in those areas, and I think he is too reliant on it, and it will come back to bite them. If you get an average Paul George and an average Kawhi Leonard game in this one, I think the Clips win. Like, you know, if they don't shoot themselves in the foot and commit 11 more turnovers than Dallas, that's 11 possessions more that they just throw away. This is an 11-point game. Like, I just think that this was one that the Clippers could have won, man. I mean, and again, Paul George and Kawhi not up to standard. Luka can't play like this. This is Luka, I mean, at arguably some of his worst. You know, I do think that he has to be – he's got to be way better. I mean, that's just borderline. A lot of things went right in favor for Dallas in this game. And, you know, they don't luck out. There's a lot of energy and effort, and Dallas made the plays. But
Luka totally outplayed L.A. Totally.
Exactly, yeah. Luka just has to be better, man.
He does, because that's the vision. The team defense can be really good, but you need insane star shot creation. You need Luka to be the guy that we always just check off. That's who Luka Doncic is. That's who he's going to be. And so that's just something to monitor going forward. I'm not freaking out about it, but it's like one game. Okay, Luka, that's a little bit frustrating. Let's take some better shots. Let's drive more. Two games. Okay, but you were a little bit better in this one offensively as a shot maker. Defensively, he was a lot better in game two. Three games, when you go 7 of 25 and you still aren't changing up your tendencies, that's where it's like, all right, is something going on here, especially when you see a knee get tweaked. But props to the Mavs. Good win for them to take an advantage in this series.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
NFL Total Access, the podcast, is getting you ready for the 2024 NFL Draft. I'm your host, Andrew Levy, and I'll be delivering two shows a week to make sure you're caught up on the very latest NFL news, including every free agency move and how it changes the draft needs of your favorite team. Draft experts and talent scouts, mock drafts, and a few shock drafts, too. NFL Total Access, the podcast, is already on the clock on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about Pacers-Bucks, Logan, because this game was incredible, incredible. Still no Giannis on the floor through three games, which is obviously concerning for the Bucks. But this one goes to OT. We get a Chris Middleton masterclass. The Pacers come through. Tyrese Haliburton game winner, Logan. Should we just start with that? I mean, what's your take on that shot, how Hallie played, how huge that was?
I don't think people are going to give Hallie enough credit for what he did in this game, man. You cannot take Tyrese Haliburton for granted. I want to be clear about something. I don't think he's at 100%. Like, he is struggling to get downhill, create separation, or anything for himself. But Tyrese Haliburton just always makes the right decision, man. I love his game. I love his game so much. And I said this from the jump when the Kings drafted him, man. It was on the tape. It was like, if he's not scoring, if he's not doing jack shit else, he is going to make a good decision, and he's going to get the ball where it needs to go. He is a consummate great decision maker, and he is so unselfish. He goes 1 of 12 from deep in this game. He goes 8 of 22 from the field, and yet he ends up with 18 points, 10 boards, and 16 assists, and he is a team best and game best plus 16 and plus minus. He is always going to make the right decision, and I stress this with Jokic, right? The Nuggets around Jokic always make the right decision. They play so unselfishly around him, and they are looking to make the extra pass on a good shot to generate a great shot. Mm-hmm. And you see it down the stretch in this one. When they kick it to Nesmith in the corner down the stretch, they pass up a good shot for a great shot. And if you mess up defensively, the Pacers are going to make you pay. And I just don't want to take that for granted. He has 16 assists in this game. Sure, that's awesome, man. He could have had way more. Haliburton is always going to make the right decision, and this team embodies it around him. How hard they play around him, the energy and effort they give, and the great decision-making and unselfish play, man. Like, the Pacers buy into the way Haliburton plays ball, and I thought that was evident all the way down in this game, man. And the other crucial thing was, I just thought Indiana just straight up out-hustled the old Bucks, man. 32 to 15 in second-chance points. They get beat 19-11 in offensive boards, 4-0 in that overtime period. I didn't know what was going on, man. I'm on the treadmill, and
incredible.
I think my video's skipping, man. The guy, the commentator keeps going, rebound by Nembhard. Rebound by Nembhard. Rebound by Nembhard. I was like,
and hey, by the way, Halliburton miss after every one of those also. Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, wait a second, man. Do I got to reboot my phone? Three back-to-back-to-back to rebounds. I think their effort was exemplified by Nembhard in overtime, man. Great ball movement every possession down. And the Bucks just don't feel like they can keep up with the Pacers without Giannis. This is a patchwork defense. They don't have enough athleticism. And I don't think they have enough youth, man. The Bucks look tired. Like, the Bucks look whooped. Are they ready and conditioned enough to go on a playoff run? I don't know. That's one of my big takeaways too, man, is if they don't get Giannis back, the Bucks goose is cooked. But they get out-hustled, they get out-executed, and I thought the Pacers' ball movement, effort, and energy was off the chain in this one, man. Big prop to Halliburton, to Nembhard, to Miles Turner, whole Pacers squad, man. This is a good team win here for Indiana, and is what you got to do, man. No Giannis, you got to make the most of all of these games. And they are steadily staving Milwaukee off. They're handling business. This is what you got to do when the other team's superstar is out.
This was a very interesting game because Indiana came out of the gate and it was just like, well, this is a good old-fashioned thrashing. Like, they are going to dominate. And then Milwaukee clawed back in. I actually thought the second half was the best defensive effort that we've seen from Milwaukee in the postseason so far. And then they just had ridiculous shot-making from Chris Middleton. It's one of those awesome games where you just have answer after answer after answer. Big shot in the clutch, big shot in the clutch, big shot in the clutch. Pressure is constantly on, and these guys are just delivering. So much fun. And Hallie comes through with the big one at the end. And it was an up-and-down game for him because at the start, the Pacers were humming primarily because of him. Like, guys were knocking down shots. The ball movement was awesome, and I legitimately think it's so infectious playing with a lead star like a Halliburton, like a Jokic, who is so fundamentally unselfish. Like, I think it just opens guys' eyes to playing basketball that way, and it's such a positive for the team offense as a whole. But out of pick and roll, he was just making perfect decisions, as you say, creating open three after open three, if that was to the popper, if that was a skip pass. And he had a couple of aggressive takes too, which I love to see, because Hallie was very passive in those first two games. He took 17 combined shots, and he's still a really good offensive player because he's still drawing defensive attention, and he's making great decisions. He's creating open looks, but I did want to see him be at least a bit more aggressive, get more into the teeth of the defense, trust his own shot a bit more. And in this game, he did, even though he had a really rough night from deep. He only shot 1 of 12 from the perimeter. I particularly liked him getting downhill. Brook was out of position and dropped one time. It just led to a nice open runway to the rim for Hallie. But in the second half, it was a lot more of a struggle. And that's where we saw, like, just the clear lack of explosiveness that has been an issue for him post-hamstring. It's the reason that he took such a huge dip in production and efficiency, because he was a super efficient isolation scorer early in the year and then just wasn't really as it progressed. And you see that in this game where he's trying to target Damian Lillard, bad defender. And he loses the ball, turns it over, can't get a step. In another instance, takes a really tough jumper against him, gets a really tough shot against Connaughton out of isolation. So, like, that just was not a good approach because he couldn't get a step on those guys, which is why I loved so much what he did on that game winner, where there's 6 seconds on the clock. He catches the ball in the backcourt, knowing that they're not going to pressure him there, just so he has a full head of steam, a massive runway, because he's not getting a step on these guys in the half court to get to that high pick and roll. They set a nice high screen for him, and then it's boom, I'm coming downhill with speed, one cross by Pat Bev, and he got the best shot that he had gotten in a while. That was fantastic. And what I loved, Logan, is that post-game he said, just give me the ball, I'm going to win this game. I love seeing that from Hallie, because the one thing you can say is that at times he can be too selfless, which is kind of a cliche, and normally it's not really true, but it can be true with him. Like, I think it was true in game one. Like, Hallie, you had to do more in that spot. I love that mentality, and I just can't wait for next season when Hallie's right again, because he's not the guy who we saw at the start of this season, and I don't think that was some fluke. I think clearly the hamstring injury changed everything, because he's not as quick.
And also just his jumper has consistently been worse than it was. This guy has been such an unbelievable shooter throughout his career and was on like a historic start to this season. And I think, again, the shot diet becoming tougher because he can't get by people. It's just really impressive what he's still doing. And I think once he is the level of scorer that we know that he can be, and he's healthy again and he's in rhythm next year, he's the perfect guy to play with. Legitimately, he is the perfect dude to play with. And it is fun to watch a great pick and roll operator who is so pass first. Like, you know, they can take over as a scorer. Hasn't been as true post hamstring, but they choose to create great shots for their teammates. It's very Nash-esque. And that's what we were all so excited about. And you get flashes of that in this game, especially early and then ultimately in the clutch coming through.
That's what's so frustrating about this from Halliburton is a lot of people, Carson, I don't know if you've seen them, like, taking victory laps on Hallie. Like,
I know.
Hallie could never score. Hallie can't create for himself. And it's like, dude, he was like the second best pull-up jump shooter in basketball pre-injury. He is an elite
25-12 on whatever, like 63% true shooting.
He's an elite shooter. He's an elite playmaker. And it's like, these guys are, oh man, he can't create off the bounce. He gets no separation. He's got an ugly jump shot. It's like, he's just not at 100%. How are you celebrating? Oh, I was right on Halliburton. He's not that good. He's a monster, first of all. And second of all, just, this is not the time to be making. It's like taking a victory lap on Embiid because he's played down and the dude just dropped 50 points. It's just dumb, man. It's stupid to me the way people are going to celebrate themselves. You're not right on this take. Halliburton's a monster. And again, the fact that Embiid can drop 50 points at 75%, the fact that Halliburton can do this at 80% or whatever he's at is insane. He is still generating such high shot quality for his teammates. And it's the little things, man. That's why I think Halliburton gets taken for granted so much. Like, creating little advantages for his teammates where they get a mismatch. Like, and the fact now that they have Pascal Siakam on this team, it's invaluable. Like, there are so many possessions in this game where he gets a smaller guard switched onto him and Siakam just goes up with it. He is a mismatch for guards, and then he is a mismatch for wings. He's too big and strong for wings. You know, even Bobby Portis was struggling with him, and he's too fast for these guys, and then he's too big and strong for guards. They just got nothing for him. And crucially, in this series, when they have Siakam just out there on the floor point blank period, when they get out in transition, it's hard to stop him, man. He is so much faster than all these Milwaukee Bucks just getting down the floor. I want to give a big credit to him, man. He's had an awesome series, and it's a little bit of a down game from him in this one compared to what he was doing in game one and two, but still attacking mismatches, still getting to his spots, still making plays. That's just what's been so frustrating, man, though. I've just seen a lot of takes online circulating that I was right on Halliburton. He's not this number one offensive guy. And to me, he clearly is.
It's frustrating because a single playoff series can become the be-all, end-all, and people don't consider factors like health, which is clearly a significant factor here. But I'm confident in the offensive superstar that he is and that he showed us that he was when he was at 100% this year. And Siakam is the perfect partner in crime, and Siakam has been clearly their best player in this series. He wasn't in this game, and that's part of why this is such an impressive win from Indiana, is because the supporting cast stepped up in such a big way. But I just made a video on Siakam because this man was leading the playoffs in scoring in terms of points per game coming into this one. He had been a mismatch nightmare, way too quick for Brook Lopez, and Brook is conceding too much ground, and he's just nailing these mid-range jumpers. He's killing him with the pick and pop and then bullying Middleton and Crowder and whoever he got off a switch with those turnaround jumpers, bullying cross matches in transition, getting on the floor quickly. That's what he was doing in the first two games. This one, I thought Milwaukee did a much better job on him. Portis, I think, matched up better physically without like conceding such a significant quickness advantage and having to give him so much room to just comfortably step in to those mid-range looks. And even on a couple switches, Pat Bev, Connaughton, those guys held up better. They forced him into a couple of tougher shots. I thought that they were smart with timing their doubles. And his jumper also just wasn't on like it has been. And they guarded Hallie well. And I thought Milwaukee got back in transition better in the second half. They were just better across the board defensively. They rotated more sharply. They forced more tough late shot clock looks. And so that's how they were able to dig back into that game after they've been really quite bad defensively overall. But I do just want to give props to this Indiana supporting cast, because you mentioned the effort element of it. That is huge. 19 offensive boards. Only one is from their center. Hallie gets five, was doing an awesome job of following his own shot, had the putback dunk in this game. Siakam had four, including that huge offensive rebound at the end of regulation that really should have ended the game then and there if he had made his free throw. Nembhard, three, and effectively four because he drew a foul fighting for positioning on the offensive glass in another instance, and also just had a big step-back mid-range jumper when they needed a bucket in the clutch. He was super efficient in this game, knocked down his jumpers. That guy is really good. And Nesmith, even though it was an off-shooting night, hits a huge three to put them up in overtime before Middleton hits another ridiculous three, but also does that at the end of the shot clock, sidestepping to adjust to a pass. Like, that was a big-time shot, and he grinded defensively. He had four offensive rebounds, so just a really, really strong effort from the supporting cast. But Miles Turner was the star of the show for Indiana. And he has been such a good offensive weapon in this series. 29 points in this game and was doing it in a variety of ways. Pick and pop with Hallie was awesome, as we know. But he also had some really good moments as a roller, drawing fouls. He hit a step back three on the first possession of the game, which was kind of ridiculous. He hit multiple spot up threes in the corner, which is just a rare thing to see from your five. He's been really, really good these last two games. Game one, he was getting good shots, but he just wasn't making them. These last two games, he's been really quite excellent. And Hallie just feeds into his game so perfectly. I looked at his stats with Hallie this year. He averages like almost 18 a game on 64% true shooting. Without him, even as they're down, their offensive number one, his production goes down to 14 points per game. And his efficiency goes down to like 55% true shooting. So he is getting fed good looks out of pick and roll by Hallie. But he was making them in this game. And that was really, really clutch because Hallie's shot making wasn't on from the perimeter. And Siakam wasn't the dominant force that he had been. And that Milwaukee offense was producing because of the ridiculous stuff that we saw from Middleton and Dame giving you at least enough.
And he's primarily a problematic matchup in this series because you have a guy like Brook Lopez on the other side of the ball. Without Giannis out there, it completely defeats the Bucks' ability to even run, you know, remotely close to that drop where you can drop everybody. And specifically Indiana, when you have a floor spacing five like Turner, you can run five out. It causes nightmares for Milwaukee. Like, they can't.
It is dragging, by design what drop coverage concedes. The number one thing that it concedes is pick and pop looks.
And that's
what Miles Turner does.
And Turner's done a great job, too, of not only knocking down those open looks, but when Brook comes out there, he's giving him diverse stuff. He's not always pulling it. He's pumping it and then driving back into the lane and generating another wide open look. Like, the driving kick game is killing Milwaukee, man, and they are just not designed to – this offense is designed to pick apart what Milwaukee does defensively. They're not good defensively. They haven't been good defensively. They are atrocious without Giannis, and it is – killing them, man. I mean, it is they're just getting obliterated, man. Indiana is running an offensive clinic, it feels like, every possession down, man, and it's on Milwaukee to really just keep up on the other end.
Yeah, but again, the second half was better. The first quarter was brutal. They just got absolutely dogged there, and they have been quite bad. Even game one, when Indiana's offense didn't produce, it was because they missed a ridiculous number of wide open looks from deep. This second half was the first time when I thought, okay, they've actually battened down the hatches here. They're dialed in. They're playing connected. Now, they still do just have personnel limitations. They're old. They're slow. Brook can't guard in space. All of that is very real. I think this Milwaukee defense is bad, but that was a better stretch from them. I do want to give props, though, to Chris Middleton for keeping them in this game because he was unbelievable. It was tough bucket after tough bucket. And I honestly thought Aaron Nesmith was pretty awesome on him. Like, Aaron Nesmith is a really good perimeter defender, and he was getting up in his airspace. He was being physical with him, but it's that Middleton special. It's the thing that has made him an all-star in this league and has always made him so captivating to watch. He's one of the greatest contested shot makers ever. And every shot that he takes basically is contested. He just shoots over you. And that's what he did in this one. It's step backs, it's turnarounds, runners, spot up looks from mid-range even, like barely any shots at the rim, and then just a couple of, oh my goodness, shots. The game-tying three in regulation, which is so reminiscent of that shot that he hit against Boston in 2018 when he had like an unbelievable offensive series, could not miss his pull-up jumpers throughout that series. And then he banks the one in an overtime, which probably lucky, probably not what he meant to do, but he still hit it. Like, that was really, really big time stuff. And he made some nice reads. And of course, it's only three games, and these numbers are now inflated by him dropping 42, but he's averaging 27, 8, and 5 on 64% true shooting in this series. Getting that version of Chris Middleton is massive. Like, he's just been something of an unknown because of availability, I would say, is the most significant thing. But seeing him also rise to this sort of offensive load without Giannis on the floor has been really, really impressive to me. And it's fun to see. And I always love when guys who are a little bit past their prime turn back the clock. It's not like Middleton is old, but we've just seen so little of him in these high-stakes situations over the last few years since the title run that this was a really nice vintage performance from him. And Dame had an interesting game where he had like a stretch of big time shot making, step back threes, but overall it was a rough night for him from the field. But he still got his 28 because he got to the line a bunch, and it was a classic Dame foul baiting on like damn near every jumper performance. I tweeted about this. I really think he gets like an all time pass for being, to me, the number one foul baiter on jump shots that we have seen. Like, Harden is obviously the perimeter player who has baited the most fouls, and they do it in different ways. Harden would kick his leg out, but like Harden, it's so much about the rip through on the drive and whatnot. Dame is the guy who I associate with pump fake, jump into a defender, try to get a foul call, do that like so, so much. And in this game, it's like, if there's any contact, he's selling it, including on a really big shot with like 40 seconds to go in regulation, and he misses trying to get a foul call. He was just very reliant on the threes and the free throws. 12 threes, 12 free throws. To me, that's not the best formula because it speaks to the fact that he's not getting to the rim, which we know has been an issue this year. And it seems like his Achilles is aggravated. Yeah. He leaves the game for a little bit with an injury, and Doc came out and said, I think it's his Achilles. So that's not good. You obviously can't have Dame anything but 100% when you're down Giannis, and even if and when Giannis comes back, like, who knows if he'll be at 100%. The Bucks really can't catch a break.
Yeah, and without Giannis, there's really no margin for error. Bigger foul grifter on jump shots, Damian Lillard or Austin Reeves?
Austin Reeves is carrying the next generation. He's a pretty good one. Dame has so many more free throws off jumpers in his career. I just have to give respect to the GOAT. I have to give props to the longevity there, but they're both doing it at a really high level. Trae Young is another really good one. Trae Young, of course, kind of the inventor of the jump back into a defender when they're trailing you out of pick and roll, which, of course, and then the league basically got rid of. They still call it sometimes, but.
And normally with the referees, man, I feel like the referees reward guys more who don't do that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they just inherently have more respect, like, for Devin Booker.
In the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah, in the playoffs. Like, Devin Booker does it sometimes, too. And just these guys who are, like, deliberately game-to-game going, hey, man, where's my foul? Where's my foul, ref? It's like, dude, it's the – you look – that's a really bad look for you as a basketball player when you're doing that, man. Like, if you don't get the call, just move on, bro. I get pleading your case, but I think it's a bad look. And –
I think it may have been a little bit dialed up in this game from Dame, though, because he was like, I don't have anything else. Like, I don't feel right. I don't feel like I can get a step on anybody. So we're just going to try to grift our way to the line. But he always does it.
And it's not only like, you know, it's not only like affecting his skill ability, too. I really wonder if it's affecting Dame's conditioning. Like, I just think it's really hard on him. And it could just be a byproduct of him getting older. Like, I think it's just really hard on Dame doing this for four straight quarters, and especially late in games when you're asking him to carry this load at this kind of age. It's just tough on him, man. And big shout out to Chris. Carson, that's a guy's game who you just can't take away. You know, it's like a big middle finger to you. It's, if my jumper's hidden, sorry. You can put all the hands you want in my face. You can do whatever. I'm going to hit it. And it's how it felt. we shouldn't be surprised. Like, we had his questions about his injuries and, you know, how much many minutes per game he was getting. Chris Middleton was still the most efficient mid-range jump shooter in all of basketball this year on a pretty good volume. He's just like that. You know, that's what I wrote in my notes, man. He's a tough bucket getter. That's just what Chris Middleton does, man. That is his game. And it is beautiful to see in these playoffs. And if we get Giannis back, say what you want about the defense, man. They're going to have just, damn, man, some scary, scary offensive pop with this big three, man. And they all really complement each other. You know what I mean? Giannis is the rim guy who's going to collapse the defense and be your lead. Lillard, we've seen in these three games, may not be the most consistent quarter to quarter, can get hot and have his stretches, has dominated, you know, really three halves of basketball, you know, where he has a slow start in this one, has a much better second half in the first two games, crushes the first half. And if you're getting Middleton at this level, it's one of the highest offensive punches in the playoffs. But it's all contingent on Giannis coming back and being what he is, man. That's the sad reality for Milwaukee.
I do want to give some props to crazy ass Bobby Portis, because he's been producing. He damn near has a 2020 game in this one. And it's, again, just like that combination of size and pretty good skill shot making. Brooke also was actually rolling some in this game. He wasn't rolling hard, but he was getting to his little floaters and whatnot. He played fine offensively. Like, the offense they've produced, even against a bad Indiana defense, has been pretty solid. It has been very reliant on old dudes making pretty much tough shots, making a lot of jumpers, but it's also old dudes who have kind of made a living off of doing that. So they are producing there. And that's where I have mixed feelings about what we're seeing from the Bucks right now. It's like, Middleton playing at this level is super encouraging. Dame playing at the level he did through the first two games is encouraging. But now you question if he's going to be the same guy going forward, if he is dealing with this injury. And of course, part of it has just been great shot making from these guys. It's not like they're getting great shots, but they are really good shot makers. So it's been good to see both of them like step up, carry this load, deliver. But then I just think about how this whole team looks without Giannis. And I broaden the scope beyond just, okay, can he come back and they survive the Indiana Pacers? And I think about where they're at as a team, and I just feel bad for the guy. Like, I just think there's so many glaring, glaring flaws here. And you see it all in the first half. They're old. Mm-hmm. They're slow. They're struggling to defend mightily. There is a glaring lack of athleticism, rim pressure, quickness on the perimeter for point of attack defense. Just anybody other than Giannis who can get downhill, who can make dynamic athletic plays. Shout out Andre Jackson, had a crazy block in this game, but he's not exactly the guy we're talking about. And it's just a bit discouraging. I don't want to count them out from winning this series, but like, this team isn't contending. They're obviously not getting out of the East. They're obviously not beating Boston. Even with Giannis back, they're just too old, slow, and poor defensively. And that just really sucks, because this is one of the 20 greatest players that we've seen, still in the heart of his prime. And last year you lose first round because of a combination of Giannis getting hurt and then Heat voodoo magic, but also just the shortcomings of the supporting cast then. And you go all in for a guy like Dame, and it seems like a home run trade. And he hasn't been the level you expected. But more importantly, more than Dame to me, it's just about the entire construction of this team. It's about still having Brook Lopez as a core guy here. Middleton balled out in this one, but like, would be nice to have some more athleticism on the wings from somewhere. I just don't like where they're at. I think they need major changes, even with Giannis. The window with this core has closed, and I think I've been too high on the Bucks for the last 2 years. And I've kind of held out on that because of how special Giannis is. And it's like, oh, maybe when they get healthy, maybe when it's all coming together. But teams this old and slow just don't win, man. And they've been this old and slow for 2 years now. But it's really, really hitting at this point.
The first guy I would get rid of would be Brook Lopez. And if Giannis comes back healthy, it empowers them to play Brook more because he covers up for a lot of Brook's deficiencies. But I would maybe think about running Bobby Portis at the five, Giannis at the four when he comes back, just for like, one of the frustrating things about Brook too is he pops so much and he is so away from the basket oriented at this portion of his career. He's never in the paint for rebounds. So any shot that goes up near the round, it's like you were just
they're not a good offensive rebounding team.
You're taking a big body away from the paint when the other team is always going to have that guy down there. So you're always at a disadvantage on the glass. He's not athletic. He's not a great rim deterrent anymore. He's not an elite shooter. Like, Brook would be the first guy that I move on from in favor of somebody more athletic, more interior inclined, period, that can just hold it down for me down there. You know, for a while, he gave them that dimension of I can get hot and splash mountain. And we saw it in this series. What, he made 6 threes in one game? I mean, we've seen it, but I think there's a lot of negatives, a lot more negatives that come with Brook, the transition aspect that, you know, I think they do need to dramatically retool, man. And to me, it starts with moving on from Brook. Honestly, Middleton's a guy that I can see aging pretty gracefully. You know, he's not going to do this every single night, but his game's not predicated on athleticism. His game's predicated on, hey, man, I'm going to get to my spot and knock down my shot. So I'm a little more optimistic that we can see Middleton, Lillard, and Giannis do something. But I think it starts with dumping Brook and getting younger, getting more athletic. It's kind of like the Suns, man. I don't really like their prospects no matter what.
But at least they have Giannis, though. At least they have a top three dude on the planet.
True. That's their saving grace. It's really just him, man. It's been pretty ugly without him there on the floor. But Brook's the first guy that I'm kind of tossing to the wolves and moving on from.
Brook has been super important to this Milwaukee team over the years, like especially their peak defensive seasons. But he's still a good pure deterrent around the rim, but he's so slow in space at this point. And it's also a problem that they're so much weaker on the perimeter. And so he's having to deal with more penetration than ever before. That sounded a bit strange out of the mouth, but you guys know what I mean. So, yeah, and just like the complete lack of any sort of vertical spacing at this stage. He can still pick and pop. He can still purely defend the rim, but he's too old. He's not the level of player they need him to be. Ultimately, I don't buy into Middleton as a third guy on a title team at this stage, and he's not getting better. He's not getting healthier. Like, I just think they got to really, really retool here, man. I think they need to make some big changes because they're all in on the Dame and Giannis duo, and Dame has to consistently be better than he was throughout this regular season for that to work alone. But then you need to get more athletic, just period, point blank. I think that applies to the five spot. I think that applies to the wings as well. We'll see how they approach that. It's not a death sentence for them, but without Giannis, I don't think they have much of a chance in this series. Obviously, this was a really competitive game, but what Indiana was doing felt so much more sustainable. Their best guys didn't even play their best in this game. Then Middleton, as great of a difficult shot maker as he is, going berserk like he did in this one. And I'm worried about seeing Giannis. I thought he'd miss the first couple games. Once you're talking about going three deep and you're down 2-1, like, that's kind of the time where it's like, all right, if you can play, you're going to play. And I do expect him to play, but we'll see. If he doesn't, what a bummer. That sucks. So I guess we'll end on that low note, Logan. We'll end just by killing the vibes.
We don't have to. Watch this.
I'm going to ask you. Yeah.
You go for it. Go, can you hit the cue?
I'm going to set you up. Any final words, Logan, before we hop off here?
Naz Reid.
Yeah. Naz Reid played basketball today, picked up a dub because the Timberwolves just keep on rolling. Appreciate all of you guys, all of you who watched along live on a Friday night, all of you who are listening after the fact. We love you just as much. We appreciate all of you guys and hope you enjoyed. If you did, there's always more Nerd Sesh. We're continuing to go live. We'll be live tomorrow night. It looks like we're probably going to be going on with Jason on Hoops Tonight, Sunday. Not 100% confirmed on that. We'll let you guys know tomorrow what the plan is. But we will have shows throughout this weekend. We have video essay in-depth content there, breaking down specific players and teams. As I mentioned, I did a video on Siakam just a couple days ago. Find that on our YouTube channel. Follow us across social, TikTok, Instagram, at NerdSesh, Twitter, at Nerd_Sesh, to see all of our social content, our trivia, to see clips from the show. You can buy the hat right off Logan's head at thevolume.com along with all of our other merch. And you can join our Discord where inspiring discourse that will give you optimism about this generation and the generations to come. Just phenomenal stuff going on in there. That link is at the link tree across our social media bios. So with that, as always, appreciate you guys. I've been Carson Brabber.
I've been Logan Camden.
And this was Nerd Sesh.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.